You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the February 2025 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair, Part B. Here's the continuation of A Killer View by Keziah Weir. It was Gorman's complaint to Martin's office, McKellar says, that triggered the select board's involvement in the herbiciding. If you're going to take somebody to court, you can send a notice of violation without the select board, but if you want to follow up, namely with enforcement action, they need us. Martin fields grievances about anything under the sun, he says, with not a little weariness, when I meet him at the town office. Their tree, their vegetation, their drainage from their property is causing a problem on my property, is how he describes the scope. More often than not, he determines these to be civil matters rather than code violations. But following his visit to the site of the poisoning, Martin consulted with a Maine Department of Environmental Protection Shoreland Zoning Coordinator on the relevant ordinance. It deals with aesthetics, erosion, water quality, those kinds of things, he says. And allegedly applying the herbicide that killed the trees, Amelia Bond had breached an ordinance, a fact Martin delivered on November 28, 2022, via a letter emblazoned with the town seal and notice of violation in large type. It came to the attention of the Camden Code and Planning Office that an herbicide was used by you or an agent of yours to defoliate and kill numerous woody trees and plants on land not owned by you at 3 Metcalf Road, Martin wrote. The town of Camden is alarmed at such blatant disregard for the environment and for the abutters' property and in such close proximity to the Atlantic Ocean. Martin gave a copy of the letter to the select board, which kicked off the first of multiple discussions. The board, whose members serve staggered 3-year terms, can be a place for fierce disagreement. But on the herbicide, board member Tom Hedstrom tells me that the issue prompted the most unifying response that we've ever had. The premeditation is really shocking, because people make mistakes, right? Says Hedstrom, an electrician, and when we speak, first-term chairman of the Camden Select Board, which makes him as close to a mayor as an elected official in Camden's government can get. But this was the tale that was told, and it's not really in dispute, as that the Bonds went and put this poison on the Gorman's trees on their property. And then 6 months or a year later, when these mature oaks, and oaks are rugged, you have to really put something on. Roundup isn't going to kill an oak. When the trees started to die, they called up Miss Gorman and they asked her for a meeting. And they went out there and they said, boy, these trees really look rough. You really ought to cut them down. Never once indicating in any way that they were the ones who had killed the trees. I mean, that type of premeditation, that is not something that most people are capable of, I believe. The violation notice, an initial select board meeting, merited the first piece of news on the issue published by the Penobscot Bay Pilot. What was that siren, and why were the cops driving by like bats out of hell, reads a self-description on the site. How did the town vote last night, and what is its significance? Is it a snow day today? Linda Clancy, the pilot's founding director, would go on to write nearly a dozen articles, thoroughly cataloging the case as it wended its way through various government agencies. After issuing the violation notice, it took a long time to work with the Bonds, Martin says. There's a significant amount of money involved, and you had two parties that were in negotiations, too. We're a third party in the middle of it. We kind of let their issues play out. their settlement play out. The settlement played out. According to a letter that the Bonds lawyer sent to Martin in December, Amelia Bond believes that she applied a product called Allegair, the brand name for the chemical tebutherion, which she bought in a 4-pound bag in Missouri to dead and or dying oak trees on the border, and here she misspells border, of the Bond property. According to Nutzi's letter to the town of Camden, Arthur Bond admitted to having cut the trees to improve their view of the harbor. By May 2023, crews had begun excavation and remediation of the site. A seasoned arborist felled the trees. A pair of backhoes stripped the soil. The whole mess was handled as hazardous waste and schlepped to the Juniper Ridge landfill in Old Town. By July, to cover the cost, Gorman and the Bonds had come to a private settlement of $1.58 million, just a couple hundred thousand dollars shy of what the Bonds paid for their house in 2018. But the town's fight had just begun. "I've worked in local government for 16 years, says Audra Kaler, Camden's town manager since 2017. "I've never seen a community that prides itself and treasures stewardship of the environment, particularly trees, the way that Camden does. So it's just kind of shocking misalignment with the values of the community to have somebody intentionally poison trees. The oaks, in particular, elicited public sympathy and imagination. In Maine, oak trees have been medicine, as used by Wabanaki tribes, and building material for furniture, the ribs and beams of ships, lobster trap runners. With their wide canopies and dense broad trunks, oaks can capture more than 48 pounds of carbon per year. While their vast, shallow root systems are excellent at managing watershed, they host about 430 moth and butterfly species, according to Kate Garland, a horticulturist at the University of Maine, and support a complex food web. The National Wildlife Federation describes the species as the tree of life. When another oak, located in Late Park, just yards away from Gorman's property, came down during Tropical Storm Lee, someone left mums at its base, and news of its demise appeared in two local papers. In October 2023, the town of Camden settled with the Bonds for $210,000 in fines for the zoning violations, plus $30,700, so that the consultancy firm Sevian Meyer Engineers could begin monitoring the nearby Late Beach and Park to determine whether the herbicide had seeped onto public land. They were doing somersaults to try to figure out how to get these people on something, McKellar says. The shoreland violation was creative and it worked fine, but it's also the type of thing that rich people get accused of doing. It's like a high society kind of thing that's not as embarrassing as being charged with criminal trespassing, vandalism, that kind of stuff. The Bonds were very cooperative, Martin says. I mean, why wouldn't you cooperate, especially when in the letter that you sent from the attorney, you indicated that Mrs. Bond did this. Whether the Bonds were cooperative or not, following an insider tip, the Daily Mail picked up the story. Dozens of other articles followed, including in the Portland Press Herald, New York Post, the Boston Globe, and the Associated Press, for which it became among the AP's top 25 stories globally and the most engaged story of the week for U.S. News. The story told is one of a respected local victimized by nefarious newcomers. As David Sharp wrote for the AP, if this were a made-for-TV drama, the story set against the backdrop of this quaint village would have it all. Replete with wealthy out-of-state villains and a sleuthing member of the venerable L.L. Bean family, Gorman's husband didn't just lead the Heritage brand, he was the founder's grandson. In the articles, the Bonds, who have declined to be interviewed for prior reporting and this article, instead submitting statements via their lawyer or ciphers. Amelia Bond was an investment banker who went on to head the St. Louis Community Foundation for 12 years, but retired amid the tree brouhaha. Arthur Bond III is an architect and the nephew of Christopher Kit Bond, the former longtime Republican senator from Missouri, whose Wikipedia page flags his exceptionally low rating from the environmental watchdog group Republicans for Environmental Protection. His consistent attempts to ban same-sex marriage and his infamous comparison of waterboarding to swimming. There are different ways of doing it, freestyle, backstroke. Reporters often noted that Arthur and Amelia Bond were members of the Camden Yacht Club until a certain point in the news cycle when they began to report that they weren't, the thinking being that they had either been kicked out or left in disgrace. In July, Camden Yacht Club director Colleen Dugan confirmed that the Bonds were not members, but declined to comment further. Almost none of the Camden locals I spoke to for this story knew them. Most had never seen them around, had maybe docked their car coming, had maybe clocked their car coming or going, though not since the story made its way to the press. People mentioned the yacht club, the golf club, MAGA. The Bonds and the Gormans are so far out of reach due to their wealth that it's interesting to talk about because we don't know them, says Holly Anderson, assistant director of Camden's Park and Recreation Committee and one-time local news reporter. We don't run into them on a regular basis at French and Braun and at the park and at the polls and at the coffee shops. We don't go to church with them, so they're very easy to talk about. Are they embarrassed? Wonders Barbara Spalding, a 65-year-old neighbor who grew up spending a couple weeks each year at her family's summer cottage on the Point and who now lives year-round in Camden. Do they feel badly? Are they regretting their decision? Did they look back and think, ugh, this view was not worth it? Martin told the Globe that he fielded calls from as far as Florida. You gotta nail those people. I get why people here care so much, he told the paper, but I don't understand why I'm getting calls from all over. Everybody's like, oh, these jet-setting political dynasty people, says McKellar. All the nuance of maybe there's another side of the story is so tiring for everybody, she goes on. People seem to be so thrilled to have something that's like, are these people definitely evil? Both Gorman and the Bonds are often described as private, though the local impression of Gorman, whose primary residence is in nearby Yarmouth, is almost universally positive. She's a wonderful neighbor, and everyone in town thinks very highly of her, says Haley McKinnon, who lives across the street from Gorman's Camden cul-de-sac. Gorman occasionally makes the main news for her disbursement of grants and other charitable gifts. An endowed scholarship for community college students in the state set up by the Gorman's children, a $4 million gift to Maine Medical Center. According to Federal Election Commission data, she regularly contributes to Democratic funds at the state and federal level. Next photo, Silence of the Saplings. Camden Harbor, as seen from the Bond property. With trees in the foreground and the harbor in the background. L.L. Bean is arguably the largest and most successful consumer exporter of vacation land charm, bringing Maine vibes to the masses since Leonwood Bean founded the company in 1912 as a purveyor of hunting boots. In 1980, the official preppy handbook dubbed it the biggest seller of the rugged New England prep look. Today, the company is a one-stop shop for fishing poles and hunting accessories, but also the duck boot, the boat and tote, percale comforter covers printed with lobsters, and wool blankets emblazoned with the state's original pine tree flag. The company's three bootmobiles, 13-foot high, 20-foot long aluminum and fiberglass replicas of the iconic brown boot built onto GMC Sierras have reportedly covered more than 350,000 miles and visited 25 states. One made an appearance at last summer's Portland Pride Parade. It was Leon Bean's grandson, the former Navy man Leon Gorman, who turned the company from a $2.25 million local venture into a $1.61 billion outdoor lifestyle juggernaut. In 2014, WealthX, an international wealth intelligence firm, named him Maine's richest person, worth $840 million. When Leon Gorman died in 2015, the flagship Freeport store famously opened 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, shut its doors for 4 hours, its first voluntary closure in 48 years. Lisa Gorman really understands what it means to be a neighbor, and a Mainer, more importantly, says McKinnon, and that could not be further from the bonds. It is the ultimate exercise in contrast. Reporters leaned into that disparity. Like other wealthy summer residents who have been building or buying big houses here for more than a century, the Gormans were attracted to Camden's serene beauty and proximity to both the sea and mountains, wrote Kevin Cullen for The Globe. They bought their waterfront home in 2002. The bonds paid $1.8 million for theirs in 2018. And yet, Amelia Bond and Lisa Gorman, on paper at least, are more alike than not. Arthur Bond III may have contributed to his uncle's Senate campaigns in the 1990s, but the only available FEC data from either Bond since then are multiple donations by Amelia Bond to the Kamala Harris campaign and Act Blue. And the Bonds' introduction to Camden actually came years earlier than their 2018 home purchase. According to property records, Amelia Bond's father, William Irvine Jack, a former finance attorney turned Colorado rancher and conservationist who died at age 86 in 2021 in Portland, Maine, purchased a place on Bayview Street with his wife Lynn, Amelia's stepmother, in 2005. 2 years later, Amelia and Arthur bought a house down the block from a couple called the McCullys, who were friends of Lynn. The Bonds dubbed their 32-foot boat, built in 2001, with a hailing port of Camden, the Wanderin, and the bungalow, logically, Dunwanderin. In 2018, the Bonds bought from the McCullys again, this time purchasing 1 Metcalf Road. The move got the Bonds significantly closer to the waterfront, and for much of the year, when the trees were bare, they had a fairly unobstructed view. But in the glorious summer months, the foliage created a natural screen. "We have various scales of ocean view," Camden's town assessor, Carrie Lichtman, tells me a few hours after visiting the Bonds' property during the town revaluation. "We have obstructed view, obstructed seasonal view, average ocean view, good ocean view, very good ocean view, panoramic ocean view. Each of these is affiliated with an influence factor, which serves as a multiplier when assessing property value." The Bonds' 12,362-square-foot parcel prior to the tree removal qualified as a good view and had a land value of just shy of $1.2 million. After the herbicide application and remediation, which cleared a significant view of the water, Lichtman has assessed the property as having a very good view, adding almost $500,000 to its value. Gorman's place, being right on the water, is in a whole other class, Oceanfront 2. It is difficult to overstate the rabid desire an ocean view can incite in Camden, with trees often winding up as collateral damage. In one 2016 instance, when a couple removed a tree near their property line shortly after moving into their new $690,000 house on Harbor Road, one of the abutting property owners had an ominous message for them. In this neighborhood, she said, as reported by the Portland Press Herald, we don't do any cutting without discussing it with the neighbors first. That woman promptly contacted the same landscaper the neighbors had used, Camden's a small town, to plant a row of pines and arborvitae, which, per the lawsuit the couple subsequently filed, constituted a main statutory spite fence that obscured their view of Camden Harbor. The case eventually landed before the Maine Supreme Court, which upheld the lower court's ruling in the new couple's favor. The court ordered their neighbor to remove several trees and trim the arborvitae to 10 feet or less, and to add a restriction to the property deed that would hold future owners to the same rules. 3 years earlier, in neighboring Rockport, one man allegedly waited until his neighbors left town on vacation before hiring someone to remove a span of their trees, plus 40 feet of fencing, to improve his own ocean view. That ensuing lawsuit ended in a $50,000 settlement agreement. In the early 2000s, Lisa Gorman herself was involved in a separate, quieter neighborly dispute. According to multiple people who recall the incident, her then-next-door neighbor noticed that 5 of the mature weeping willows growing on his side of the property line had been cut down. When he raised this with Gorman, she suggested he call her lawyer. Rather than go to court, the two parties agreed that Gorman would replant the space with trees of her choosing. A source close to Gorman says, years ago, an inadvertent mistake concerning a property line was made by a landscaper who promptly took care of the problem to everyone's satisfaction. Unfortunately, we learned that the herbicide poison applied by Arthur and Amelia Bond has now spread into our Late Beach Park and Camden Harbor, the Select Board wrote in their 2024 annual report, published in June. We remain committed to rectifying this situation by all means for the safety of all of us and doing everything we can to make sure it never happens again, including working with our law enforcement agencies. 2 months earlier, Sevian Meyer presented a report to the town detailing trace levels of alligator found in samples from test bores at the beach and park, above laboratory reporting limits, but below EPA residential and protection of groundwater exposure risk guidelines. Although what has been detected may appear to be within the EPA standards for risk, the state of Maine does not have a standard for this herbicide, says Martin. Among locals, there remains suspicion of adverse effects. Last February, McKinnon and her partner, Will Addis, lost their 10-year-old terrier to liver and kidney failure. He was perfectly healthy, 10 years old, before we moved here, says McKinnon. We moved here the year that Amelia Bond started applying this pesticide, and we took him down to that beach all the time. It's really hard for me not to draw some kind of connection. Addis interjects with a fact check. We don't know that. Last year, a beloved red oak in the public park toppled over following gale force winds. Martin doesn't believe the two events are connected. Out of curiosity, McKellar wants the tree tested for tebutharion. To residents, the herbicide on Late Beach feels personal. If you don't own an oceanfront property in Camden, says Hedstrom, you only have a few places that you really have great access to the ocean, and that's one of them. Still, the herbicide is just one of many threats to the beach, which consistently ranks among Maine's most polluted and frequently test positive for high levels of enterococci bacteria. Pardon my mispronunciations, an increase scientists link to sea temperature rise. The expanding population of this story's itchy red herrings, the brown-tail moths, has also been linked to climate change. In a 13-month period, reads the 2024 town report, Camden experienced 5 FEMA-declared disaster events that caused damage from high winds, overland flooding in our watersheds, and coastal flooding that fundamentally changed much of the eastern seaboard of the United States. The storms left Gorman's own stairs down to Late Beach in disarray, and the enormous granite public steps as mangled as the mouth of a person who just had their teeth punched in. The herbicide incident coincided with other rapid shifts. The pandemic and the influx of new residents and the turnover of new people really fundamentally changed that community, says Kaler, the town manager. Even though the two groups of residents who are at the heart of this issue were here prior to the pandemic, it spotlighted a lot of these changes in tensions. According to the New York Times, since the pandemic, Maine has had the 7th highest in-migration rate in the country, and in 2021 was the only state where the median age declined from the year prior. Camden officials say that one consistent reason they hear from people for their move to Maine is rising temperatures elsewhere in the country. Certain newcomers spend most of their lives elsewhere. Reserving seaside Camden for the year's hottest months. Some people embrace the part-time residents, and some people can't raise their middle finger high enough, says Leichtman, Camden's assessor. There are, he says, fiscal benefits to having so many partial year residents, including that they pay taxes without using public services year-round. But they also drive up property values, making it doubly difficult for people who work in Camden, at the schools, in the service industry, as caretakers for those very vacation homes, to find a place to live. In Camden's 2024 revaluation, we're adding about $700 million of value to the town, says Leichtman. The real estate market changed that much. Hedstrom and other community members have sent emails to the Maine Attorney General and to their district attorney requesting prosecution. In response, Scott Boak, Assistant AG, Chief of Natural Resources Division, noted the substantial remuneration already paid by the bonds. We will consider all of this information and the underlying situation carefully, he wrote, in consultation with the BPC, DEP, and other interested state agencies, as we consider your request related to further enforcement. When reached for comment by Vanity Fair, the Maine Attorney General's press liaison responds, I cannot confirm or deny the existence of any investigation. In order to prosecute a case, I would need a police investigation, Natasha Irving, DA for Maine's Prosecutorial District 6, which includes Knox County, wrote to the Select Board on February 29, 2024. I can look into this. By July, she let Hedstrom know that she was declining to pursue criminal charges, and the correspondence soured. One concerned citizen emailed Irving, copying Hedstrom and others, outlining statutes she believed relevant from criminal mischief, which carries a penalty of up to 5 years in prison and a fine of up to $5,000, she wrote, to other charges associated with environmental protection laws. In following emails, Irving responded that Bond's admission to applying the herbicide was not an admission to intentionally destroy the property of another, and that the tree valuation under Maine law is low, making a felony conviction unlikely. I understand that you and members of the community want the bonds to be held criminally liable, she wrote to Hedstrom and other officials. Conduct can be appalling and abhorrent, and still not provable as a crime. It shouldn't be something that you can just pay your way out of, Hedstrom says. One of the things that I think is important is for people to accept responsibility for their actions, show remorse, be willing to answer hard questions, and apologize. The bonds sincerely regret these circumstances and the unintended consequences that were created, the couple's lawyer said, in a statement he sent to Vanity Fair. They have expressed remorse and have consistently taken steps to address the situation, and they will continue to cooperate with the parties given the seriousness of the allegations. People make mistakes. They do things that are selfish, do things that cause harm, and they don't even realize they're doing it. Both Hedstrom and McKellar have experienced the worst kind of this butterfly effect. McKellar had served on the select board for less than a year when her younger sister, 32-year-old Kristen, went swimming with a friend in Damariscotta Lake, 40 minutes out of town. At dusk, McKellar tells me in the clipped tone of someone who has had to repeat a horrible fact, she was hit by a motorboat and died. The boat's driver, a Massachusetts resident, was indicted for reckless operation of a watercraft, operating a watercraft at an imprudent speed, and manslaughter. When Irving became district attorney, she dropped the manslaughter charge under a deferred disposition agreement, meaning a court postpones sentencing contingent on the accused fulfilling certain conditions. And in 2019, the man pleaded guilty only to the reckless operation charge in exchange for 100 hours of community service and a $400 fine. In 2021, he was arrested again in Maine, this time for allegedly driving 99 miles per hour in a 70-mile-per-hour zone on I-95 and operating a vehicle under the influence, with a blood alcohol level nearly twice the legal limit. He received a new deferred disposition agreement that included 21 days in jail. Hedstrom originally ran for his seat after a fire in a building without a certificate of occupancy killed one of his sons, 14-year-old Theodore. Racked with grief and frustrated by what he saw as systemic failures and a lack of code enforcement that may have prevented Theodore's death, I ran for the board because I wanted to make a difference in this community, Hedstrom says. I wanted to show people that you can make changes within the system. Has anything changed in Camden? Representative Vicky Dudera, a local real estate agent currently serving her third term in the Maine House of Representatives, is planning to propose legislation that will increase penalties for misuse of herbicides and pesticides and to address intent. And in August, at a select board meeting, Martin drafted a proposed notification and reporting code that would require licensed applicators, arborists, lawn companies, etc., to notify abutting neighbors and the town of Camden in advance of application, as well as annual reports of applications of herbicides, pesticides, and fertilizers used in town. In November, Camden residents voted overwhelmingly in favor of adding the new chapter to the Camden Code. Amelia Bond's actions wouldn't have fallen under this ordinance, since by her own account, she elected to apply the herbicide herself. Last 4th of July, while a group of locals perched on the seawall near Lake Beach, getting ready to watch the fireworks, potentially Camden's last display, another recent topic of select board debate, according to one person there, an apron-clad private chef emerged from the house of a remote local millionaire bearing, rather than request to clear out, a basket lined in a red checkered cloth, brimming with cookies and brownies to disperse. At Lake Beach and Park, monitoring will continue biannually through next fall, which means that 2 years in, Martin and other town officials have continued to meet with the Bond's attorneys to draw up further agreements. They clearly want to continue to cooperate with the town and resolve this situation. I don't think this is probably good for them, Martin says. I think what they really need is, what's the end? Can we continue this forever? And I understand that. For now, they're drawing up an interim memorandum to cover further liability for the continued monitoring, which thus far comes to an estimated $40,000. In August, Hedstrom resigned as chairman to spend more time with his son, who lives in Europe, but remains on the select board, which continues to meet twice a month, every month, to discuss the town's issues. And through the seasons, a baseball hat has remained on display in the window of Symmetry, a shop in town, broadcasting a mantra, "More trees, less bullshit." Atlas Shrugged by Dirk Smilley. A brawny bodybuilder with a generous side, Scott Minard was an atypical Wall Street sage. But as CIO of Guggenheim Partners, he oversaw billions for the firm and made millions for himself. His sudden death shocked even those closest to him and spurred infighting over his $400 million estate. Opening photo shows Scott Minard wearing a suit, dual nature, publicly. Scott Minard was a financial sage and one of the most influential voices on Wall Street. Privately, he was a gym obsessive, aiming for the muscle-bound ideal of Mr. Olympia and Mr. Universe. On the last day of Scott Minard's life, he awoke before dawn in the big house, what friends called his Spanish Revival mansion in Rancho Santa Fe, just north of San Diego. The six-acre estate has its own vineyard and horse stables, a palatial master bedroom warmed by a 17th-century-style fireplace, and a lagoon with waterfalls and a swim-up bar. Neighbors once included the former chair of Hewlett-Packard, who reportedly paid the Rolling Stones $2 million to perform at a private party for his wife just down the road. Minard was new to Rancho Santa Fe, having fled south from Marina del Rey to escape the pandemic, but he got COVID anyway. When he awoke that morning of December 21st, 2022, he felt sluggish. Was it just jet lag from a recent 17-hour flight he took to see the World Cup in Qatar? The lingering symptoms of long COVID? Or maybe another late night watching Monty Python episodes on his phone, which he was known to do? He was a hypochondriac, said a friend. Every day he woke up, Scott thought something was wrong with him. As global chief investment officer for Guggenheim Partners, he oversaw nearly $300 billion in assets under management at the firm. Minard was constantly in motion. If he wasn't in Zoom calls and portfolio manager meetings at his office in Santa Monica, he was on the road. He visited the Kennedys in Hyannisport, shared the stage with Al Gore at Davos, debated Tony Blair at the Milken Institute Global Conference, enjoyed a Dodgers game next to Magic Johnson in the owner's box. One of his last major deals for the firm was joining Elizabeth Murdoch in a $100 million investment in LeBron James's entertainment outfit, the Spring Hill Company. That was the public Minard, a financial sage and one of the most influential voices on Wall Street. His private interests were atypical for the quarter-zip world of high finance. He loved bodybuilding. At 6'3" and more than 300 pounds, he wore a 75 regular jacket and required an extra-wide chair at public events. His lifting regimen included weights so heavy that they wore holes in the shoes of his gym shoes. Getting ripped gave Minard an acute sense of well-being. He was obsessed with workouts, high-protein meals, and muscle-bound physiques a la Mr. Olympia and Mr. Universe. Next photo, Saving Grace, Minard with his husband Eloy Mendez and rescue dog Gracie, a Shiba Inu Labrador mix. As Gracie got older, Scotty got younger, said a friend. The morning of the day he died, he devoured a bodybuilder's breakfast, a pile of high-protein pancakes, no syrup, likely brought by his housekeeper. He flicked on his Bloomberg terminal to assess European market news, then checked to see how Asian markets had performed that day. Scrolling through his email, he forwarded a video link of monarch butterflies to his longtime friend Terry Chiota. Minard kept his gym life out of public view. Ironically, his last moments were caught on camera. According to a source, closed-circuit video at the gym is said to show Minard, after a fierce round of upper body work, walking off to get a drink of water. Moments later, he turns around and drops like a rock. Gym members rushed to his side, and paramedics soon showed up. Not long after arriving at the Palomar Medical Center in nearby Escondido, he was pronounced dead of probable cardiac arrest, according to his death certificate. Chiota got word of his passing from Minard's husband, actor and producer Eloy Mendez. Mendez had arrived with Gracie, Minard's rescue dog. Gracie sniffed the bed where her owner lay, then lay down under it. Minard was 63, It was 4 days before Christmas. 2 weeks later, friends, family, and colleagues gathered at the Lux Sunset Boulevard Hotel in Los Angeles. From there, they boarded shuttles to a secret destination. Among the 150 or so guests were CNBC's Brian Sullivan, O.J. Simpson defense lawyer Robert Shapiro, L.A. real estate mogul Robert Barth, and financier Michael Milken. They gathered at the Brentwood home of political pollster Frank Luntz, a friend of Minard's for a decade. Luntz is a true blue Dodgers fan. One of his favorite possessions is a 2020 Dodgers World Series ring Minard gave him as a gift. Guests were asked to drop their cell phones into sealed bags. Minard's body lay in wake in an open casket in Luntz's residence. Minard once said he admired the hybrid nature of Luntz's home and mini conference center, with its whimsical artifacts of political Americana and a replica of the Oval Office. A few years earlier, Luntz had hosted a conversation between Minard and Tony Blair. The following day, mourners trekked to the 62-acre Hollywood Forever Cemetery. Minard's nephew, Matthew Minard, a former monk and now professor at a Byzantine Catholic seminary, gave a graveside eulogy. The biggest surprise, a shock to some, was Minard's final resting place, a hand-carved white marble sarcophagus the size of a minivan. The above-ground tomb sits on its own peninsula overlooking a lake with turtles and blue herons in the Garden of Legends, not far from Burt Reynolds. The estimated cost? $4 million. Who gets buried in a sarcophagus? Popes and kings, usually. Napoleon, Ulysses S. Grant. Minard was neither a statesman nor Hollywood royalty. True, he was the face of Guggenheim Partners and liked to think of himself as a Bond king. But this grandiose final gesture in a celebrity cemetery seemed a bizarre final act in Minard's life. He would have hated it, said a friend. Or would he? Minard had a following worthy of a royal. At Davos or the annual Milken Conference, corporate leaders, celebrities, and even heads of state sought Minard's financial guidance. So did show anchors on CNBC and Bloomberg, platforms on which he was ubiquitous. His 140,000-plus acolytes on X, traders, brokers, investment managers, catapulted Minard's stinging criticism of Fed policy and crypto predictions across social media. Minard's physical girth mirrored his outsize influence on capital markets. He controlled a lot of money and was an early managing partner of Guggenheim Partners, one of the hottest Wall Street startups in decades. What he didn't control was the chronic anxiety and inner turmoil he felt in both his public and private lives. While Minard presented as a financial demigod, he had his share of personal insecurities. Minard's conservative Presbyterian mother never accepted her son's sexuality, a friend says, nor did the faith of his youth. I witnessed some of his emotional flare-ups myself in meetings and encounters with Minard as his colleague at Guggenheim, where I was chief content officer for 6 years. Scott was like a quantum entangled particle, said another friend. He had both an inferiority and superiority complex. Other aspects of his private life are surfacing in a messy legal skirmish now unfolding in courtrooms in California and Nevada. The court cases are driven in part by an oddly crafted will, which failed to codify promises Minard may have made to those who say they were closest to him. As he built Guggenheim's asset management business, Minard was quietly creating his own fortune worth an estimated $400 million. He owned real estate, derivatives, art, investment holdings, and interest in numerous business entities. He was one of the largest private shareholders of Guggenheim Partners. Among his possessions at one time, a 15th century styled California castle with moat, drawbridge, and five-hole golf course. At least another 10 properties, including two penthouse condos in Florida, which he bought for $12.5 million, a helicopter at the Los Angeles airport, and a museum-worthy art collection, which was said to include a Miro and Van Dyck. But in the 2 years since his death, Menard's estate has been subject to claims involving two of his close friends, Chiota and Alex Figuera. Both contend that in exchange for making themselves available 24/7, their fealty would be rewarded with multi-million-dollar California homes he had bought and allowed them to occupy rent-free. Chiota walked, boarded, and cared for Gracie. Figueroa was Menard's longtime personal trainer and, per his court filing, lover. The estate's personal representatives, Menard's longtime business associate Robert Fedoris and Peak Trust Company NV, contend in a court document that, at least in Chiota's case, there's no proof Menard promised her a house for anything. In a filing, their lawyers say the situation has caused a probate nightmare, giving rise to extortion. Chiota's lawyers have volleyed back in court, suggesting Menard's will is fraudulent and that Fedoris is unfit to administer the estate. Filled with oddities, the 6-page typo-laden will was filed in Nevada, according to a filing by Chiota's lawyers. The vast majority of Menard's assets are in California. The composition of the will stands in stark contrast to Menard's otherwise meticulous approach to wealth management. His methodical investing strategies, borrowed from behavioral economics and one of its pioneers, the late Nobel Prize winner Daniel Kahneman, author of Thinking Fast and Slow, who was a Guggenheim advisor. One of its concepts is to understand loss aversion, how investors feel far more pain from losing money than happiness from an equivalent gain. Another is that cognitive biases can be removed from the investment process by understanding two basic modes of thinking, the intuitive and the rational. Rational investing requires thinking slow, not fast. Menard used ideas like these to guide Guggenheim's growth in assets under management from $35 billion in 2007 to nearly $300 billion more than a decade later. In 2017, all six of Menard's flagship bond funds earned 5-star ratings from Morningstar. In 2019, he was involved in high-level discussions around his potential appointment to the 7-member Federal Reserve Board. That year, Bill Gross, then Wall Street's undisputed bond king, who once oversaw $2 trillion in assets, was asked who might succeed him in claiming the fixed income throne. He said only one name came to mind, Scott Menard. Menard's confident, scrupulous investment persona belied a complicated interior life. Anxious and depressed, as one friend described him, he wanted constant control of the people around him. Most anyone requiring someone to board their dog or offer personal training would simply hire part-time professionals. Menard wanted Chiota's and Figuera's undivided loyalty at all hours and was willing to pay for such devotion. Was Menard's impulse to control people in his off hours compensation for the lack of control he felt in his own workplace? His industry peers, PIMCO's Bill Gross, Bridgewater's Ray Dalio, Double Line's Jeff Gundlach, had enormous influence over the firms they helped build. Menard never had that kind of power at Guggenheim. He was reminded of this when he reportedly lost an epic battle with CEO Mark Walter in 2016. A confidant of Walter's was promoted to global head of the institutional distribution team, reportedly not Menard's first choice. She then restructured the U.S. distribution team, axing 22 staffers. Minard was furious. Rumors spread that he would quit. He stayed, but moments like these must have left him with a sense of being diminished by peers inside Guggenheim. During Minard's most successful years, the firm's management committee consisted of then-President Todd Boehly, Walter, Executive Chairman, Alan Schwartz, and Minard. Boehly was off building a small media empire, acquiring Billboard, The Hollywood Reporter, and Dick Clark Productions, producer of the Golden Globes. Schwartz had famously scored a stunning coup, landing Guggenheim a key advisory role on the $130 billion Verizon-Vodafone buyout, one of the biggest deals in global corporate history. Walter organized a Guggenheim investor group with Magic Johnson and others to buy the Dodgers for $2.15 billion, more than doubling in value since. Minard had his own projects, as they were called internally, like the LeBron James deal, but nothing like these. He could have co-invested with Walter and Boehly in the Dodgers acquisition, but declined, a decision one friend said Minard likely regretted. This article will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service, and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selections by Mark Hoffman.